Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, April 16th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital. Welcoming Dr. Ramez Awad to the Saratoga Hospital Medical Group Ear and Sinus Surgery Practice located in the Wilton campus, saratogahospital.org, for more information. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Stephen Jovenon of Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. He's here to answer your heart and health questions. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Cardiology, your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio this afternoon is Dr. Stephen Jovenon of Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. He's board certified in internal medicine, cardiology, and echocardiography. In addition to practicing general cardiology, he performs procedures such as implantation of cardiac devices. Dr. Jovenon earned his biological engineering degree from Cornell University, graduated from Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. Welcome to Vox Pop, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Everybody, we're going to get a lot of calls today. Now is the time to get on the phone if you really want your heart question answered. To participate, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wmc.org. Okay, for change, Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
I don't hear much about heart transplants or any rejection drugs anymore. Anything new there?
So that's a field that's slightly out of my expertise. So when I was at NYU, we did LVAD procedures, assist devices. NYU just has gotten into heart transplants. I did some training at Columbia, but rejection drugs are difficult to deal with. They do have to shut down your immune system to allow the new heart to be a part of your body. And I'm not aware of anything brand new that's come out regarding that.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay, and let's go now to George in Otsego County. All right, George, you're on.
Hi, thanks, doctors. For an elderly person with atrial fibrillation, is an electrophysiologist the only or the best person to determine whether that person is a candidate for the process called ablation to help with that atrial fibrillation to make it more normal?
Well, thank you, George. That's a great question. I'm very biased because I am a cardiac electrophysiologist, and I perform cardiac ablations such as for atrial fibrillation. So from my standpoint, I would say that's the best person. But the doctor who knows you best may also be a good person to help make that determination. It's a somewhat complex decision. Ablations are being performed more and more frequently these days. The safety of ablations has improved, in my opinion, over the past several years. We now have catheters that can sense force inside the heart, so it's harder to push too hard on the inside of the heart when performing an ablation. It's also, I think, a more successful procedure than it had been in the past. So I would say at least a cardiologist is somebody who can help refer you to the right person for an ablation. But in my mind, the best person is an electrophysiologist.
And explain, doctor, if you can, what an ablation is.
So an ablation is a procedure, and in the case of atrial fibrillation, where we go up through the veins in the legs to make a map of the inner surface of the heart. And atrial fibrillation tends to come from an area of the heart called the pulmonary veins. So sleeves of tissue within the veins that return blood from the lungs back to the heart. It turns out that area is actually not so important in terms of electrical function for the heart, but has kind of, I would say, nuisance triggers for atrial fibrillation. So what one can do with a catheter is create lines of scar around the veins to prevent those triggers from getting out into the rest of the heart. And if one can create durable lines of scar, potentially atrial fibrillation can be cured in some patients, sometimes lifelong.
Thank you, George. Okay, let's now go to Emily in Warwick. The telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. Emily in Warwick, you're on.
Hi, I wanted to ask if the medical literature overwhelmingly supports a whole foods plant-based diet with no oils for, for prevention of cardiac problems, why most cardiologists are still not endorsing this or promoting it?
I think it's a matter of personal preference, Emily. It's a great question. I don't endorse it necessarily in every patient, but you're right. The data demonstrate that at least a vegetarian diet improves your chances of going on without a heart attack.
And do we know why that is?
I believe it's just animal fat and bad types of fats getting into the bloodstream, increasing LDL levels, the bad type of cholesterol. And it seems that a vegetarian diet is the best way to reduce that risk. There's probably multiple reasons for this, though. That's probably not the only reason. But we know that a lot of people live a long time, whether they're vegetarians or not. So some cardiologists do recommend that. It's a matter of personal preference, I think.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and on to Robert in Kiamisha. Okay, Robert, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll be quick. I went to my cardiologist for an uninvasive way of detecting any clogs in my arteries of my heart. And she did a CAT scan. They did a CAT scan. We drew some calcifications that they couldn't see through the walls of the arteries. So they did, of course, a cardiocath. So I had 50% and 240% blockages in my heart. My father had open heart surgery. I think he had a triple bypass. My grandfather never got to that point, but he had heart disease, and all his sisters do, and brother on that side, my mother's side of the family. So I'm at risk that way hereditarily. How often do you think I should go, or when should I go? I had my last cardiocath a year and a half ago. When should I go again?
Robert, can I ask how old you are?
Sure, 58, and I just stopped smoking a month ago.
Well, congratulations on that. So,
thanks.
First off, before I answer your question, the most important thing you can do is modify your risk factors for progression of your coronary disease, and you do have some moderate blockages that you've described. Quitting smoking is the single best thing you can do for your overall health, blood pressure control
Blood pressure is great. I also have diabetes, and they have me on Abenacar for blood pressure. It's a blood pressure medicine, but protects your kidneys, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So that may be, I might have, who knows, I might have natural high blood pressure, but it's controlling it, and it's really low. My heartbeat is very sedated. I exercise 4 days a week, like 3 hours of racquetball at a time, blah, blah, blah. So,
are you on anything for cholesterol?
I do. Atorvastatin 40 milligrams.
So controlling your risk factors is the most important thing you can do. To directly answer your question about surveillance, I'll be a little bit evasive about it because a cardiac catheterization, although it is generally a safe procedure, it does carry a tiny risk of complications, even if it's done for diagnostic purposes. Most cardiologists will follow your symptoms and will assess you clinically and will also recommend stress testing on some sort of regular basis. And a stress test is a way to evaluate whether a blockage in an artery is functionally severe. So you've described moderate blockages. Now, to see if those have progressed to severe blockages, one can do either a regular stress test where we slap EKG electrodes on you and see if there's any changes that occur with exercise, or a nuclear stress test where we look at the blood flow to the heart muscle before and after exercise to see if there's any evidence of stenoses that are now severe. But most people don't routinely recommend repeating invasive catheterizations necessarily, not unless there's progressive symptoms, an abnormal stress test. You know, if you have one of these stress tests that's abnormal, or if you have evidence of a heart attack, then it's a no-brainer. You got to go back and look. But there is no time.
So Robert, got to take a break, but we thank you for your call. Okay. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks for your help. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, providing orthopedic care for hip, knee, and other joint pain. Information at feelbetterwithbassett.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering Master of Social Work degree options with flexible schedules at the open house Thursday, April 19th from 6 to 8 in Poughkeepsie, adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. Patricia Fennell, founder of AHMA, and Lee Shapiro, MD, director of the Scleroderma Center, and their research teams now conducting the Pathways to Scleroderma study. AlbanyHealthManagement.com. Albany cardiothoracic surgeons providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the capital region. Practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. And from Mass Match, for over 16 years, a locally owned dating and matchmaking service connecting singles through private matchmaking in Western Massachusetts and beyond, massmatch.com.
And welcome back. We are here with Dr. Stephen Jovenon. You can help me with this.
Jovenon.
I love it. Dr. Stephen Jovenon, a cardiology associate of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. I am so sorry for murdering your name. I've tried
That's okay.
it, but I'm not doing well. Okay, so let's go to David in New Paltz. Okay, David in New Paltz, you're on.
Hello, doctor. How are you?
Doing great.
I have a question. I was reading an article in Time Magazine about longevity and such, and they've done different studies about heart and pacemakers and stuff like that. And what they said, that there was a study that they found that since they've taken the bottoms of shoes from leather to rubber, they found that people were needing more pacemakers later in life. And that was because they said that the leather from the bottom of your shoe let the electromagnetic force of the earth come through your body, whereas when you wear rubber soles and rubber shoes, like sneakers and synthetic products, that it cuts off the electromagnetic flow to the heart and the body, and that it causes heart problems and pacemaker type of situation.
Okay, got it, David. We'll go to the doctor. Doctor.
Well, let me ask you, is this for people who already have pacemakers? Their pacemakers last longer, or are you saying that people have less of a need for pacemakers?
Well, they did a thing with the Amish and different groups in the United States that go around barefoot or part of the time have leather soles on their feet, and they found that those communities didn't have to have pacemakers, or they ended up with less heart problems.
So I find it hard to believe that sneakers or shoe type would affect your need for a pacemaker. But there certainly could be some confounders here, right? The Amish or people who don't wear shoes probably don't have EKGs done regularly. That's just my guess. It's maybe not as frequently as the regular population. And some people end up getting pacemakers without realizing they actually need one at first. Pacemakers are often in there to prevent a problem, right? If you're at high risk of developing something called heart block, where your heart could just stop for long periods of time or get very slow and get very sick, sometimes they're put in preemptively. So in people who aren't screened regularly, they may not end up getting pacemakers because they haven't been screened. These problems haven't been caught early enough. So that could be a reason. I think to mechanistically explain it, I'd have a hard time otherwise.
Thank you, David. All right. And now we're off to Kingston, New York, and talk to Jim. All right, Jim, your turn.
Good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
Hello?
Yeah, yes. We can hear you.
You got to speak right into the phone because we're having a little trouble. Go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Better, but not perfect. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm 87. I have diabetes, and I had rheumatoid arthritis and AFib and an aortic aneurysm. I wonder what you can suggest for me in view of the fact that I'm suffering from these ailments.
Can you tell me more about your atrial fibrillation? Have you had it for a long time?
Yes.
About how long?
At least 6 years.
Yeah. So atrial fibrillation is a difficult thing to eradicate and cure, especially if it's been with you for a long time. Is your atrial fibrillation all the time, meaning it's persistent, you're always in atrial fibrillation, or is it something that comes and goes? You may not know the answer to that.
No, I'm always in AFib, and the numbers vary widely.
So
my pulse seems to be in the 80s.
Yeah.
With the exceptions, you may go to 70.
Okay, Jim, we're having a hard time hearing you, so let the doctor just say a few more things. Go ahead.
Yeah, so atrial fibrillation is a hard thing to cure, especially if it's been around for 6 years and if it's been persistent. What we typically do in a situation like yours is we try to rate control the atrial fibrillation, prevent it from going rapid. So putting you on medications like beta blockers or calcium channel blockers to prevent it from going fast is usually the recommendation, because procedures like ablations and antiarrhythmic drugs are not perfect. They don't work in everyone, and they carry risk. And you may not feel a lot better in a normal rhythm versus atrial fibrillation. So once it's been there for 6 years, if I were seeing you and if you were my patient, I probably would recommend staying on medications to control it and to have you on blood thinners to mitigate the risk of a blood clot forming in the heart and causing a stroke.
And Stephen, I guess the question of the day is, what is atrial fibrillation?
Yes. So atrial fibrillation is a rhythm where the top chambers of the heart are essentially quivering, going about 600 beats a minute. And not all of those impulses get through to the main pumping chambers of the heart, the ventricles. But it does so in an irregular fashion and tends to be a rapid fashion. And atrial fibrillation is problematic in that it can cause symptoms of a rapid and irregular heartbeat. But the other problem with atrial fibrillation is a lot of people don't realize they have it. And if they're not properly protected, if they're not on blood thinners, a clot can form in the top chambers of the heart. And that clot can go anywhere. It can go to a limb. It can go to an abdominal organ. It can cause a heart attack. But the main concern is that it causes a stroke, because that's the most irreversible kind of damage that could occur as a result of a blood clot forming in the heart. So it's a very important problem. It's an increasing problem as our population ages. There's evidence that more than 10% of people over 80 are in atrial fibrillation, and the number is probably more than that as we develop more tools to diagnose it more frequently these days.
Thank you for that. Okay, so now we will go to Chad in Albany. Chad in Albany, your turn.
Yeah, hi. I had bypass surgery 4 years ago, and I just got around to asking my cardiologist where they took these veins from.
Mm-hmm.
He said they had taken my leg, but I have no sign of anything coming out of my leg. I have no scar, so I didn't want to argue with him. The other thing is the surgery was done down in D.C., so he wasn't part of that in any way. So I was just curious if you had any ideas about that.
Yeah.
I know they took an artery out of my chest.
Do you know how many bypasses, how many vessels were bypassed by any chance?
Five.
So that's a lot of vessels. So there's a very good chance that they used veins for that. Now, there are ways to do something called a jump graft, where they can attach one vessel to multiple arteries to bypass multiple arteries with one or two vessels. But like you said, the one in the chest, the left internal mammary artery that comes out from the subclavian artery, is by far the most common one used. Sometimes people use radial arteries. So you may have a scar on your wrist where they may have harvested a radial artery from one or two sides. I am also highly suspicious that they did use a vein from your leg or multiple veins from your leg. And there are less invasive ways of harvesting veins these days from the legs. And I don't pretend to be an expert on cardiac surgery and all of its elements, but vein harvesting is done through tiny incisions these days. So it used to be, you know, long scars to get rid of to kind of harvest veins for the heart muscle itself. But it may be done without you even realizing it.
Thank you, Chad. All right. Now off we go to Mark in East Greenbush. Okay, Mark, your turn. Hey,
hello.
Mark.
Hello.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, no
I'm
problem.
70 years old. I'm 70 years old. I have a 70% blockage in my left carotid artery. I'm going in Tuesday to Ellis to have, I guess, it cleaned out. I know they block it off above and below the blockage. They close it off, and then they do the surgery. My question is, what are the chances of something loose getting loose when they open me my artery back up, going to my brain and stroking me?
Well, thanks for that question, Mark. That's a great question for the surgeon who's doing it. It always depends on the technique. But, you know, in my experience, the incidence of a stroke from a procedure like this is very low, probably somewhere in the 1% range.
1%, you said?
Yeah, and that's an estimate based on, you know, the stroke literature post. The procedure is called a carotid endarterectomy. The thing is, it's done to prevent stroke in the long run. So you're taking a tiny risk up front to prevent a stroke in your later years. And, you know, it's a complex decision whether that's worthwhile for you. So you have to have trust in your doctor, whoever referred you, and whoever's doing the procedure, that they're doing the right thing for you. It sounds like they are.
Yes, I have a 50% blockage in my right carotid. He is not going to touch that. He said that's okay. I just am concerned about having a stroke after they open the artery back up. That's all.
Yeah, the risk of that is not zero. So you are right to be concerned. And I tell people, you know, who I refer for procedures, the same thing. You know, there's a tiny but real chance of a complication. But we wouldn't be recommending this to you unless we thought it was going to do a net benefit in the long run for you. So, yeah, tiny risk of a stroke up front, but maybe much less risk of a stroke down the line with that carotid artery fixed up.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. What a day. 1-800-348-2551. And let's go now to Jen in Chatham. Okay, Jen, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, doctors.
Hi, Jen.
Hi. So my question is, I have recently been recommended for a third cardiac ablation for pretty high burden PVCs. And I'm at New York Presbyterian right now getting care from the chief of electrophysiology there.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is I had one failed ablation. The second ablation worked for a right ventricular outflow tract mm-hmm. location of my PVCs. But the strange thing is that I have a new morphology of my PVCs that are now coming from the posterior interventricular septum now. How rare is it for the morphology of your PVCs to change after a successful ablation? And in a third ablation, is it an endocardial approach that they take when they go through the rib cage?
Say that last part again, when they go through the rib cage?
Yeah, do they for this particular left-sided location, do they mm-hmm. go through the xiphoid process or the rib cage to access this location?
Yeah, so I can answer all of your questions, I think, at once here. So you know, I perform these PVC ablations as well. I have some experience with these. It's somewhat unusual to be recommended for a third ablation, but not totally unusual, not crazy at all. You know, it sounds like you have a brand new PVC. That's what you're describing. And, you know, what can happen, and I have to look at your EKG to know for sure. Actually, you can tell on an EKG where the PVCs are coming from with fairly good certainty. What can happen is the focus of the PVC may be near the RV outflow tract where it was ablated before, and it may have just shifted morphology as a result of the prior ablation. It depends on how different it looks now. You're sort of describing a situation where it's maybe popped up from a completely different site.
Yeah.
And if it's a left-sided PVC, so if you're describing something that's coming from the left ventricle, which it sounds like you are.
It is, yep.
Yeah, it would be rare, very rare, to have to go under the rib cage. That would be an epicardial approach, meaning
epicardial,
coming from
okay.
the outside of the heart, which is not what we would do up front. Almost never, I would say absolutely never. You would never start that way. For a procedure, you would start endocardially. But endocardially, you could go one of two ways. So if it's going to be on the left side of the heart, left ventricular in origin, one can either go through the vein, like was done for your RV outflow tract PVC, and then actually cross into the left side of the heart through a transseptal, something called a transseptal puncture, where you go from the right atrium to the left atrium. Sounds scary, but quite safe, done under ultrasound. I do a couple of those a week, and they tend to go very well. And one can get into the left atrium and then the left ventricle that way and search for the PVC site of origin. The other way to do it is to go through the artery in the leg. So you could start off in the artery and then actually cross the aortic valve. The aortic valve separates the left ventricle from the aorta, the main artery that pumps blood out to the rest of the heart. And that's another good way to kind of map and look for the PVC origin in the left side of the heart. So,
do you think it's a, do you think it's a good idea to stay with the same physician or the same physician that's mapped you previously, or do you think second opinions are a good idea when you're getting a third?
I think it's better to stick with who's done the procedure before. There may be tiny nuances about your heart that they only know. And if it is a shift in morphology from the previous one, they're going to be the best.
Very weird. He was very like, wow, this is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, Jen, we got to let you go. Yeah. A lot
Thank
of people
you.
Behind you. Thank
Great
you.
Great question.
And thank you. Thanks.
Stephen, I wanted to ask you a question, if I may, and that is, what is a PVC?
Yeah, that's great. we're jumping the technicalities to kind of help the callers.
Is that an extra beat or something like
that? Yeah, so it stands for premature ventricular contraction. So these tend to come in single beats. And there's a couple of reasons why one would want to get rid of them. One is if you feel every single one of them, every time your heart skips a beat, it may become very annoying. Some people, one out of every two or three beats is a PVC, and it can drive them crazy. Another reason to try to get rid of these is it actually can cause your heart to overwork. And if you have enough extra beats, the heart function can decline. And that's a good reason to do an ablation to try to get rid of the PVC. Those are the two main reasons.
Now, a lot of people have these.
Yes, they're extremely common. In fact, if you were to put a monitor on either one of us or anyone else around here, everyone has some, you know, or most people have some. But some people have an extremely high burden of them, which kind of pushes us to do something more about them.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay, now let's go, if we can, to Sally on line number four. Okay, Sally, you're on.
Yes, hi. I would like to ask a question concerning a left ventricular failure cardiomyopathy diagnosis. How severe is that, and can it possibly ever be operated on?
Sure. Can you be more specific by any chance?
Well, not really. This is someone that is very close to me and is not in this country, but they have a severely dilated left ventricle problem, and they are down to approximately 10% functionality on the left side.
Got it.
Can you give me any information on
Sure.
What
so
to do
just
about that or
just to
how,
tell you more
serious,
about
how,
the audience more about what a cardiomyopathy is. All that means is a weak heart muscle. So, you know, in your friend's case, 10% is referring to the ejection fraction or the amount the heart squeezes out of whatever comes in. So, normal is about 50%. So, that's fairly advanced. There are many different causes for cardiomyopathy or a weak heart. The most common by far is prior heart attack. So a lot of it depends on the mechanism of what caused the cardiomyopathy. Uh-huh. Some people,
there's never been a prior heart attack.
Yeah, it can happen for no reason at all. We call that idiopathic in the medical
we don't
field.
Know.
We don't know. Yeah, and honestly, it's treated medically for the most part. There are assist devices and devices that we can put in to resynchronize the heart and help it get better. So
I think
depends.
He already has a pacemaker, by the way.
Yeah, so sometimes a fancy pacemaker, one that can resynchronize the heart,
right.
A biventricular one, if he doesn't have that already, may be helpful. It depends on the electrical system of the heart.
So Sally and
Doc, is that a very severe diagnosis, or can one survive with just medical, medicine and?
So survival is extremely variable. It depends on the condition. Depends on the person's age. And people can live for a long time with that, but that is a significant, diagnosis to have.
So Sally and Doctor, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Gotta get on. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Zachary, take it away.
Support comes from Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont. Offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture, specializing in Lyme disease. Now accepting new primary care patients, windhorsenaturopathic.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. Berkshire Country Day, an independent pre-K to 9 school. Comprehensive curriculum and an emphasis on community. Open house May 10th. Intentional, independent, inspired. BerkshireCountryDay.org. And from Studio KTM Salon, Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color, from corrective to fashion by stylist Kristen Marquette. StudioKTM.com.
We are here with Dr. Stephen Jovanone of Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. Okay, so every line is taken, of course. We have lots of people who are sending in stuff over the email. Let's see what we can do and how fast we can go without ticking anybody off. Okay, let's go to Bernard in Burnt Hills. Okay, Bernard, Burnt Hills, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I eat a very high-fat, low-carb diet, a lot of coconut cream, a lot of avocado, and a lot of eggs. And I'm just wondering where cardiologists stand on eggs and the effect on the heart with respect to cholesterol.
Good question.
And, you
okay.
Know, just want to get your take.
Okay. Here's
depends a little bit on your underlying cholesterol profile, your LDL. I'm not a big, proponent of cutting out things like eggs out of your diet. I think, as long as you reduce animal fats and you eat healthy fats, it sounds like you've described all relatively healthy fats. I'm okay with it.
Right.
How about egg whites?
Egg whites are great. High in protein.
Yeah. High
low
in
cholesterol.
And throw out the yolks,
yeah.
Although people will yell at me and say, that's weird. Okay, so forget that. Okay.
The yolks are the best.
That's the tastiest part,
well,
right?
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes there are good things that are the best but don't help you. And Bernard, you asked the question. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go now to, Lori in Fort Edward. Lori in Fort Edward, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling for my boyfriend. He has cardiomyopathy. And he's on the medications of verapamil, toprol, and lauristin potassium. Is there any other medications he could be taking or anything you could suggest?
You've described some of the mainstays. The verapamil usually is for a rapid heart rhythm, not so much for a weak heart or a cardiomyopathy. We talked about that with our previous caller. There's a drug called spironolactone, which is in favor now for cardiomyopathy. Especially people who have congestive heart failure. That's a big one. The other one, the newest one is Entresto, and that has some good data behind it as well. You probably see commercials for it on TV.
Okay, Lori, thank you. All right, now let's go to Jerry on the Thruway. Jerry on the Thruway, line number three. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm in my mid-60s. I had a heart attack about 10 years ago. I had one stent put in. I'm on Plavix, so clopidogrel, aspirin, and alpha and beta blocker. Are these lifelong medications now?
So the Plavix, not necessarily. It depends on where the stent is in your heart. 10 years is a long time. Aspirin, yeah. I would say, is lifelong.
Right, that, yeah.
Beta blocker can be lifelong, especially if there was a substantial heart attack. But the Plavix, you should talk to your doctor about.
Yeah, it was minor. I mean, I didn't even know I had a heart attack. I thought it was indigestion, so.
Yeah, you may want to get off the Plavix at some point.
Okay, thank you, Jerry. Oh. All right, now let's go to, okay, yeah, Carolyn in Red Hook. Okay, Carolyn in Red Hook, you're on.
Hi, question is about my dad. He's in his mid-90s. He had aortic valve replacement about 11 years ago, and he's, over the last year, gotten increasingly tired. He's never had cholesterol issues, had a good diet and reasonable working exercise, and had developed some blood pressure issues, monitors at home, and it was put on a low dose, but it made him really tired, and it wasn't holding. He does have atherosclerosis, and at his age, his choosing is not a lot of activity, so he's not moving around as much. So between the atherosclerosis and the valve replacement that long ago, I'm wondering if I can see the change, and I'm assuming that it's related to the atherosclerosis, perhaps partly the blood pressure medication, but it could also be congestive heart failure or, you know, aortic valve having a lifespan.
Yeah, there's a couple ways to answer your question. One is, you know, the blood pressure medication, if you think it's a culprit, it's usually pretty easy to cut back on the dose or stop it temporarily to see if he feels better off of it. And that's what I would recommend to assess whether the blood pressure
actually
medication.
They tried switching.
Yeah.
I think they didn't want to take him off it for too long because his blood pressure was really going up 150s, 160s,
yeah.
170s.
Yeah. But
and now the diastolic is higher as well, not just the systolic.
The other thing I would also look at is an echocardiogram, reassess that valve. And you mentioned congestive heart failure. It's important to know whether the congestive heart failure is due to
I don't know if he has it.
Yeah, it's important to do an ultrasound of the heart or an echocardiogram to understand the function of the heart and to look at the valve to directly visualize it.
All right, and atherosclerosis, which I know he has?
Yeah, that's treated medically. You know, aspirin, statin. You know, your dad, who's 90.
Yes, he takes a baby aspirin.
You want to try to avoid invasive procedures because invasive procedures have risks.
Right. Does the aortic valve surgery have a lifespan? He got a pig valve?
Sure, but I tell you, that lifespan is just an average lifespan. It can be much longer.
And what is it?
We'll say 10 years, but,
so
I've seen them last
that.
30 years. So it's not a definite. You know, it's something that the only way to know is to look at it with an ultrasound of the heart.
Thank you,
That's
Carolyn.
Important.
All right, now we'll go to Barbara in Chatham. Okay, Barbara in Chatham, your turn. Go.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate this show. I just wanted to make a comment on David's comment earlier about grounding. We just watched a film called Down to Earth. It was fantastically informative about the necessary need of the body to be grounded with all the electromagnetic interference that happens that especially affects the electrical current in the body, which runs through the heart.
Okay, is there a question, Barbara, there's a lot of people on the phone. Is there a question here?
Well, if there's a heart issue, I'd suggest watching the studies and looking
great.
At this film, Down to Earth.
Okay,
thank you.
We'll keep
thank
that
you.
In mind. Thanks.
All right. Let's go to let's go to John in Pattersonville. John in Pattersonville, you're on.
Quick question about calcium score.
Yeah.
Tested 2 or 3 years ago. I was low 30s. Just had it tested again. Haven't got the results yet. What numbers should I be worried about?
Well, can I ask how old you are?
67.
Yeah, so the calcium score comes with an average for your age. So it's broken down into quartiles. So you said low 30s before. If it's
31,
gone up,
33, something like that.
Yeah, that would be on the low side for somebody your age if that were the same score now. So you should look at the percentile ranking. It sort of puts you into statistical category, you know, 50th percentile, meaning your average, or 75th percentile. And it can tell you what your risk is. It doesn't tell you whether you have severe blockages. It tells you what's the likelihood of having blockages.
And when you say low or high,
Low is good. Lack of calcium is good in the heart. If you have lots of calcium in the heart, there's a higher likelihood of obstructive or severe blockages in the arteries that supply the heart muscle.
John, thank you. Okay, and now on to Roger in Niskayuna. Roger in Niskayuna, you're on.
Yes, hello, Dr. Jovanel.
Hi there.
Hi. Quick question. We've heard for years about the benefits of active exercise like cross-country skiing or biathlon or running or things like that. My question, I've read a lot on the internet and other places about passive cardiovascular exercise, that is like watching scary movies or going on roller coasters. Is there any heart benefit to these activities?
I don't know the answer to your question. I'll say that first off, right off the bat. But anything that increases your heart rate stresses your heart. So I suppose it's not how I would recommend to get your exercise. Exercise to me is you know, a mind and body
exercise
thing.
It's just raising your heart rate through experience, really.
Yeah,
but
I understand.
Lot of people tell us to walk all the time. So I walk a lot. But, you know, you have to walk pretty fast to really raise your heart rate, don't you?
You do.
But if you were sitting still.
Moderate exercise is reasonable. You know, get your heart rate 100, 110.
Sure.
Sure. I haven't read about it. I don't know about passive exercise. Maybe you could teach me something. But, sure, okay. I don't see why not.
Okay. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you. And so what happens when you get up in the morning and you have blood pressure of 135, but, you know, 2 hours later it's down in the basement? Does that happen a lot?
It can, especially if you take medication. Because before you take your medication, it may be high. If you take some blood pressure pill, it may plummet as a result of it.
All right. Let's go to Nancy in Pottown in Poughkeepsie. Nancy, you're on.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the MTHFR mutation and homocysteine levels.
What's your question?
My question is, if somebody has the double allele for the C677T mutation for MTHFR and their homocysteine levels are high as a result of that, are there any dietary or other measures that they can do preventively to not get heart disease?
So, I treat those people the same as the general public. And you probably want to have a hematologist sort of advise you further on this, because that's something that they specialize in. But there's an increased risk of thrombosis, or, you know, and that could be in the heart arteries or
can be
anywhere.
And what is thrombosis?
So clotting, a blood clot can occur as a result of this mutation. But I don't have any dietary recommendations. A hematologist may have some recommendations about blood thinners like aspirin or other forms of blood thinners, but I just look at them as a higher risk population without any.
If the homocysteine levels are high, but if all of the if the lipid profile is normal, so are they still considered? My daughter has this mutation, and she's 30 now. And I know when she was in her early 20s, her LDL was in the 130s, which was surprising because she had been a vegetarian, you know, for a couple years before that.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, beside your suggestion for a consult with a hematologist, if you had anything else that you would recommend.
Not really, and it's not a huge risk factor for clots. You know, a lot of people have this mutation, actually. It's fairly common. So it's an important thing, but it's not, you know, it's one out of many risk factors, like cholesterol, like high blood pressure, like family history.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Nancy. Yeah. Okay, and we're off to Jim in Malta. Jim in Malta, you're on.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. My question is it unusual to have a cardiac event or symptom go back and forth or come and go over the years? In 2009, I was found to have a left bundle branch blockage, but I was told it's nothing unusual to worry about with someone over 65. Then 3 years later, I went for some other tests for something, and they said, and by the way, your bundle branch blockage is gone. Then 2015, just before surgery, I had an EKG, and they said, you know, you have the bundle branch blockage, but nothing to worry about. And then just a year ago, I had surgery again, and no mention was made of having that. So is that strange for that to come and go?
So that's not strange. So left bundle branch block refers to an electrical block or delay on your EKG. So there are electrical cables connecting the top and bottom chambers of your heart. And one of those can be slower than the other, creating a pattern on your EKG, described a bundle branch block. And it may depend on your heart rate. So there's something called a rate-related bundle branch block, where if your heart rate goes above a certain number, the left bundle may not be able to respond as quickly, and you may develop this bundle branch block. Whereas, you know, if the heart rate dips below a certain number, everything conducts normally, and the EKG looks narrow.
In between those findings, they did detect, my GP did detect the PVC.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I went for the following test, and that's where the doctor said, well, don't worry about the PVC.
Yeah.
And besides, your left bundle branch blockage is gone. Could those be related?
Probably not, but what I would have everyone look at is what were the heart rates during each of your EKGs, and okay. Does the left bundle branch come with an increasing heart rate? That would be my guess.
Jim, thank you. And now let's go to Barbara in Stone Ridge. Okay, Barbara, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to know the difference between mitral valve prolapse and aortic regurgitation and what your opinion is on taking antibiotics for, say, a dental procedure.
Great question. So mitral valve prolapse is the valve that connects the left atrium, the filling chamber of the heart, returning blood from the lungs, and the left ventricle proper. Prolapse just means it bends backwards. So it doesn't necessarily mean there's anything dangerously wrong with the valve. It's actually quite common to see prolapse or some extra bend to the valve. We don't do much for it anymore. There was a time when people thought it was a marker of a serious disease, but it's probably not. Aortic valve regurgitation, that's the valve that connects the left ventricle to the aorta, the main artery of the heart. And it depends on how significant the regurgitation is. Almost all valves are leaky, actually, at least to a trace degree, if you're to look carefully at them. So if it's just a trace amount or a mild amount, we actually quantify them with studies like echocardiograms where we look at ultrasounds of the heart. If it's mild, it's nothing to worry about. To address the question on antibiotics, that's a more complicated question, and society guidelines have gotten away from recommending antibiotics for dental procedures because it turns out that you have transient bacteria in your bloodstream very frequently for just like brushing your teeth, for example. So it seems silly to prophylax somebody for a single moment in time when you're going to have bacteria transiently in your bloodstream sort of on a daily basis.
Okay, thank you. All right, and now we're going to go to Angus in Dalton, Massachusetts. And Angus, this has got to be a fast one, okay? So here we go. Angus, it's got to be fast.
Thank you very much for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I've got chronic Lyme disease, and I was diagnosed with Lyme carditis. It has gone back and forth, but I've had irregular arrhythmia in my heart, and right now I'm in a place where things are okay.
Okay, so Angus, we're out of time, so you have to tell us, what's the question?
Yes. Has there been any more studies done on Lyme carditis?
So I am an electrophysiologist. I see Lyme disease in the acute setting where it causes heart block. I really am not aware of the chronic Lyme carditis picture. So it's not an easy question for me to answer. I often refer these people to infectious diseases specialists that deal with Lyme disease entirely. So I'm going to have to take a quick pass on that one.
Thank you, Angus. Okay, I want to give a very big thank you to Dr. Stephen Jovanone of Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine for joining us today. I want to apologize to Holly and Joanne, both of whom were left on the line. I am so sorry. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay tuned now for a news update.